Hey everybody, Gregory Conley here with what is actually an unexpected edition of the Your Video Store Shelf podcast. Today is Saturday, April the 21st, and just a few minutes ago I gave good old Uli Lommel a call. And we were supposed to do an interview tomorrow afternoon, most likely, and we just decided, hey, in the old filmmaking spirit, why not just do it now? So I want to welcome to the show right now the director and probably writer of Diary of a Cannibal, his latest in a long series of films put out by Lionsgate. That comes out on April 24th, and by the time you listen to this, it'll already be out. Uli Lommel, how are you doing?
Hi there, good. Thanks for calling.
Oh, no problem. It's you've been in this business for so long that now that I think about it, of all the guests that we've had on this show, you've been around the longest.
Yeah, actually, I was already on stage with my dad when I was 4 years old, so that's like 58 years ago.
God, you've definitely got them beat. So tell us, Uli, Diary of a Cannibal. I know you probably have made 5 films since then, but what do you remember? What are the details about that that film?
Well, it's loosely based on a story that actually took place in Germany of two guys sort of figuring out, you know, all this good work. I think in Germany the way it unfolded was that some guy put some kind of a note on the internet that he wanted to be eaten alive, and then somebody, you know, said, okay, I'll do it. So in Germany there's a law, though, that you can't do, you know, anything about anybody who's living, and so we couldn't do this movie really based on these two guys, but nevertheless I found the whole concept so interesting that we said, we're just going to turn it into an American story, something that takes place in America, and we're going to make it between a man and a woman. So a man would get in touch with a woman and would say, you know, let's get together. And in the course of it, he would say, the ultimate sacrifice in love is that I give myself up and you kill me and you eat me. And then I'm yours and I'm inside of you forever. And she, of course, thinks he's nuts. But then, you know, they fall in love deeper and deeper, and he gets her to a point where she's willing to do it, and she kills him, and she takes his heart and his liver and his kidneys and eats it.
I remember being fascinated by the story that inspired Diary of a Cannibal all those years back. It was so out of this world in some ways to hear about two guys, they meet, and let's eat each other, or let's have you eat me.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you took... what were you saying?
The interesting thing in Germany was that the guy has been on trial, and his defense was that he said, look, I only did what this guy wanted me to do. And, you know, I just helped him out. And how can this be murder? And so they never had a case like this. They were actually kind of confused. The whole judicial system was kind of, you know, didn't quite know how to deal with it. But, you know, ultimately the judges decided, they don't have a jury like in the United States and Germany, but so the panel of judges decided that it was murder and premeditated, and so now he's in prison for, I don't know, for life, I guess. They will have a death penalty.
You kind of, with having to change a story because of the German law about not making movies about people who are still living, you also ran into that problem, but not so much, with your BTK killer movie and how you, I believe it was, you had to wait until the conviction occurred for Lionsgate to keep themselves out of trouble?
Right, exactly. And the same thing's been happening to us when we did Kill a Pictim. I actually, you know, our research people told me that he already had confessed, and so I thought, okay, well, the guy had confessed, so let's do something like that. And then when we finished Kill a Pictim, turns out that there were like 1,200 signatures from Canada, you know, demanding that we do not release the movie out of respect for the victims and the whole process in Canada. And so, you know, that's what we did, and we're waiting now to hear what the result of it will be. But my understanding is still that he early on confessed to like 40-some killings. But I guess now his defense says that the confession doesn't count. That he has rethought the whole situation, and so that's why this endless trial is going on now in Canada.
Yeah, I murdered several people, but wait, nah. I've decided now that I didn't. So, how was I see on the IMDb page for Diary of a Cannibal is Gillian Swanson and Trevor Parsons, the two male-female actors that you had fall in love and eat each other, and is this film set up in a way where you're spending most of the movie with just Gillian and Trevor?
Well, actually, the whole movie is in flashback, and what happens is that Gillian is the female character. She is in prison. She is in a hospital ward, and she's about to die. And two detectives show up, and they want to know, what's going on. And what we find out is that Gillian's character was discovered, eating her boyfriend, and so she was taken to jail. And then in jail, she was beaten up because the mother of her boyfriend, found another woman to kind of go after her, since the mother believed that this was just murder and her son had really nothing to do with it. And so, from her deathbed, Gillian's character sort of tells us the whole story. And leaves it up to us what we think, who did what, and what we find out in the course of the story, of course, is that the boyfriend really manipulated her into this and made her do it, and ultimately she was so brainwashed that she did it, and she went all the way.
Is this another one of your films that people would probably describe as being abstract?
Well,
it seems like the way that Uli Lomel makes a movie about two people that fall in love and want some cannibalism to occur is completely different from the way that 90% of other filmmakers would probably do it.
Right, that's right. Like, Zombie Nation, I think, is a great example. Zombie Nation really is more of a metaphor. It's not about zombies, it's about the state of things, and so that's why it's called Zombie Nation. And I guess the misleading thing might be that since the campaign has a zombie on the cover of the DVD, people think it's a typical zombie movie, and then it is not. Now I thought about all these campaigns that are misleading, maybe, and I was kind of trying to figure out how I feel about it, but since I believe that I work a lot with subversive way and with symbols and metaphors, and maybe when one expects one thing and then gets something completely different, people can get disappointed or upset or angry or whatever, and maybe those people that would have liked the movie to start with never saw it, but. So, I'm still debating within myself how I feel about certain campaigns that are certainly not representing the nature of the movie. And on one hand, I like it because it gets people to see the movie, and that's really what I want. On the other hand, I have myself a problem with misleading the audience.
And in Zombie Nation, you actually did sort of have zombie characters.
Right.
It was just that, I guess, you found the cover art that actually showed more of a decayed zombie to be misleading.
Exactly. And I mean, even in the case of Diary of a Cannibal, the campaign that ultimately was decided on shows a male cannibal that almost looks like from 1,000 years ago or something. So, I don't know. It's in my mind, I haven't really figured out yet how I feel about it. I mean, there's a part of me that doesn't like it at all, and there's another part that tries to find something, you know, that works. But, I mean, overall, I really like working with Lionsgate, but some of the campaigns, and I don't think that Lionsgate even themselves make the campaign. There are, like, people in between. Some of the campaigns and the misleading nature of it, I'm not too, you know, too thrilled about it. I think one could get the same effect with something that is more closer and truer to truthful to the nature of the movie.
I think a lot of it probably has to do with a lot of the stuff that winds up getting used is probably stock artwork or something that somebody had already produced, and as a result they just kind of get thrown onto a cover of a film just to make it look the best that it possibly can, even if, because most likely the people actually making the artwork for your movies and even the people making the decisions probably haven't seen the film.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now that you mention this, it is absolutely possible, and it's kind of wild. But, that could be.
And when you came back, I'm looking at the cover art for Diary of a Cannibal, and ever since you made your little your comeback with the Lionsgate horror films, you have had almost always, somewhere on the front cover from the director of The Boogeyman. And to be honest, when I first saw that, and I picked up, it was the key art for Zodiac Killer.
Right.
Or the Zodiac. Which one was yours?
It was the first one, the Zodiac Killer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When I looked at that and I saw from the director of The Boogeyman, I thought that they were talking about, even though I'd seen The Boogeyman as a child, I thought they were talking about Stephen Kay, who directed the 2005 remake of Boogeyman.
Yeah.
So in some ways, your return came at the perfect time, because not only did it hit the people that had seen and remembered your film from way back then, it also seemed like current to the video store people.
That's right, and actually, I thought it was pretty cool that they did another Boogeyman, and by the way, I sold them the rights to do so, but because it gave me a chance to revive mine, and I think there are a whole bunch of people who prefer mine, and quite frankly, so do I. I don't know how you feel about it, but...
I prefer yours.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, with so much money, you know, we made my movie for $300,000 back then. In 1980, $300,000 is like $1 million today. So, I mean, we did it for practically nothing back then. And I think they spent like $10 or $12 million on this new one, and I just feel there's no real spirit or anything in it. It's just, you know, I don't know. But how one can have so much money and then come up with nothing is kind of amazing to me.
How long ago did you sell the rights to Boogeyman?
Well, the original Boogeyman was made in 1980, and I only sold the original rights for 7 years, so I got the rights back in 1987, and then I licensed it once more to Anchor Bay in the mid-90s for another 5 years, and then when this new Boogeyman came out, I licensed it again like a couple of years ago to Sony.
Oh, actually, I was more talking about the actual licensing or sale. Uli and I actually just got cut off there for some reason. Hopefully Skype does not close again. Please don't. And I was actually going to ask the question, when did you sell the remake rights over to Sony?
Yeah, the remake, what happened is that Sam Raimi, I think 4 years ago, announced at the Cannes Film Festival that he was going to executive produce The Boogeyman. And I said to myself, how strange, I didn't know anything about that. Because it's sort of my title. I mean, I did like 3 or 4 of them. And so I got in touch with him, but they didn't even respond. And then finally I went to an attorney and I said, look, send them a letter, you know, I mean, we need to talk about this if that's what they really want to do. And so they sent me back a letter and said, well, Boogeyman, the title, is public domain, so forget about it. And then I said, well, How about Halloween? Halloween is a holiday like Christmas. It's certainly public domain, but what about if you would want to make Halloween today? You think you could get away with that? So they said, well, okay, so we'll give you $5,000 just to shut up. And I said, come on, guys, you're going to make a $10 million movie? And then, I mean, you know. So anyway, in the long run, after about a year and a half of negotiating, we agreed on something, you know, and then, like, I guess two and a half years ago, I licensed it to them. So they are, under the current terms, they are allowed to do Boogeyman 1 and Boogeyman 2, which I guess they just finished Boogeyman 2.
Oh, and, God.
Yeah, and at that point, I will get it back, and what I want to do when I get it back, I want to do a remake of the original one.
That is a total Ule Lomo idea, if I've ever heard one.
Yeah. I want to do it shot by shot, you know, just line by line, shot by shot, just remake it exactly the way it was, just on a different location, different costumes, different actors, you know, but the same lines, exactly the same lines, and the same length of each shot.
So did you like the Psycho remake all those years ago?
Well, you know, I mean, the original is so cool that that everything else, you know, I don't know. I still like the original a lot, and I remember I must have been like, I don't know, 12 years old or something like this when it came out, and it was unforgettable, you know.
And with the, well, with the original Boogeyman, looking back, don't you see, is it just in your head you don't, you think that there are things that could probably be improved about the original Boogeyman, but because you want to remake it, it's not right to fix them?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you got a point. That's certainly an alternative to fix all that, but I just thought it is something that I don't think has ever been done, that you remake a movie line by line and shot by shot, and every shot has to be exactly the same length. And the close-up that comes after 3 minutes and 15 seconds has to be exactly like 3.5 seconds, and, you know, exactly from such and such angle. So I thought it might just be something fun to do.
You know, if you're dedicated to that crazy of an idea where you're going to be actually paying that much attention, I think that it could be very, very fun.
Yeah. Yeah. One should then play them together at the same time, you know?
Yes, yes. There you go. And was it the Boogeyman money that financed Uli Lomel's return, or was it just a coincidence?
Yes, it was.
So it was the Boogeyman money?
It was Boogeyman money. And I actually, what had happened in addition is I had a retrospective a half a year earlier before I started with Lionsgate in Europe of my movies, including my horror movies from the 80s. And there were a bunch of fans, and they were in their 20s, like mid-20s, and they weren't even alive when I made those 80s movies. And they said, oh, I saw Boogeyman 25 times, and I saw Evans Volterra 10 times, and I love Olivia and Brainwaves and stuff. I said, really? You're kidding. And they said, yeah, why don't you make horror movies again? And so, you know, I came back to America, and Boogeyman came out, and Lionsgate came, and, you know, and then the rest is history. And we created a little studio, like, in Venice here, California, and we have, like, a whole bunch of people. It's like a mini circus, and we have our own equipment, our own, you know, locations, pretty much, and it's always pretty much the same team that makes these movies, so we're like, shooting and editing and everything, like, 24/7 for the last 2 years.
Yeah, and in those 2 years, how many films, if you can even think of it off the top of your head, have you actually produced, including the ones that aren't out on the market yet?
16.
Yeah. That is ridiculous, Uli.
I know. It's insane.
So what was the situation? Was it you sold Lionsgate Zodiac Killer and then they came calling for more, or did you guys have a deal set up beforehand?
No. They were kind of, I guess Zodiac Killer did pretty well, and then they said, why don't you do a BTK and Green River back-to-back? And I said, okay. And when I was done with them, they said, well, we do three more. And so that's how it always went. And I remember we had a screening of The Tomb, and they liked The Tomb, and they said, okay, why don't you go ahead now and do Black Dahlia, Mummy Maniac, and The Killer Nurse. Is that cool? Yeah. So it was always about, like, making three, four, or five more movies.
And The Tomb, I think that you just said, is actually going to be coming out maybe in May, I think the date is. Or June, maybe June.
May or June. It comes out after...
Curse after, of the Zodiac.
The Zodiac, but, yeah, exactly. So it's like Diary of a Cannibal, then Zodiac, and then The Tomb.
And I want to come on back to the Lionsgate and the Boogeyman question. But now that we have mentioned Curse of the Zodiac, what made you dip in the Zodiac well twice? Was it simply Lionsgate wanted another?
It was a combination. The first one, the first Zodiac was really a total experiment. It was the first time I did something digitally because I had only shot 35 before that. And so we experimented, and I wasn't so sure whether I was happy with the result of the experiment, but then Lionsgate wanted it, and it did okay. And in the first one, I play myself, you know, the Zodiac, and the film also takes place in Los Angeles. And so for the second one, I really wanted to go back to San Francisco. I like San Francisco. I always thought there's so much atmosphere in that town, and I wanted to do a movie that is closer to the reality of the Zodiac, and not a complete fantasy. And so Lionsgate liked that idea too, and so we did another one.
And you also went to the sequel well with good old Boogeyman, and you mentioned in interviews in the past that you didn't want to make Boogeyman 2, and as a result, you decided to experiment a bit. So the first 45 minutes of the movie was pretty much footage from the first, and it seems that that trend followed into the third movie, although I've never seen the two sequels.
Exactly. Yeah, what happened is I came out of the Rainer Werner Fassbinder school. I made like 10 movies with him, and we were like very much into, you know, political movies and kind of art house movies and stuff, and so for us, it was like ridiculous to make sequels. I mean, that was something we would never do. And it was still sort of a part of me when I came to America that I really felt that way. And when Boogeyman was such a success, that was it for me. I didn't want to, you know, plunge into that again. But then everybody came, including Paramount Pictures, and wanted me to make the sequel. Until finally I said, okay, if I can do whatever I want and call it Boogeyman 2, I'll do it. And they said, okay, go ahead and do it. Well, of course, they weren't prepared for me, first of all, using a lot of footage from the first one, but also what I did is I made a movie about myself because I played a lead in Boogeyman 2, a director who doesn't want to make a horror movie. And so there's something in England called the Encyclopedia of Horror Films, and there's a review in it of Boogeyman 2, and they really say, well, it's less of a horror movie than a movie about Hollywood, low-budget filmmaking, and a good director that doesn't want to make a horror movie. And so what happens is that all the distributors and producers and actors that want to convince me to make that movie, against my better judgment, the Boogeyman comes and kills them all. That's sort of Boogeyman 2. And when the people who gave me the money for it saw it, they were just absolutely speechless. They couldn't believe that I had done something like that, you know.
I was just going to ask, so with taking 45 minutes of footage from the first one, or whatever the actual figure is, where did the money go?
We didn't get that much money for Boogeyman 2, so we did use the money to do everything else that we did. But for me, it was more of a statement that I wanted to say, okay, guys, here's my kind of a sequel, you know. But today, when I look back at it again, I would say, it was maybe more about my personal feelings and my personal reservations about secrets and exploiting yourself and stuff like that. And but I don't think it's it's a good thing to do because, you know, the fans or whatever, they expect something else and they don't want to deal with you know, personal issues that a director has about sequels. So I think about, when I looked at it today, I thought it was a bit of a juvenile idea of mine. And if I would do it again today, I wouldn't do it.
Is that kind of why you're starting to have mixed feelings about the presentation of your Lionsgate films?
Yeah, I do. And I'm at a crossroads right now anyway. I think the 16 movies I made, that's sort of it for now. And I'm in the middle of like a major kind of turning inward kind of period where I'm thinking, cool, where am I really going from here, and what really happened in these last 2 years? Because I feel a little bit like a heavy metal band or like a punk rock band that's been on tour for 2 years nonstop, and after a while you don't even know anymore what time you're in, you don't even know, you know, what's going on, and you know, and then you go to the record company and say, hey guys, you know, I need a break. And, you know, this band needs a break, and that's how I feel right now.
Because it seems that you've been an incredible asset to your managers, Lionsgate, over the past couple of years, because it's like every other month, and sometimes twice in 2 months, they can fill a slot with an Uli Lommel film that they're able to probably get for less money than they would a lot of the other films that they release.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, they're doing well with it, and that's why they're continuing. And so right now, beyond those movies that you already mentioned, there is still Baseline Killer out there. There's still a movie called Dungeon Girl that's basically based on this Austrian girl that was caught in a dungeon for years. Then there is Borderline Cult that deals with these 400 women that disappeared at the Mexican border in Juarez. That we finished, and then of course, you know, Boogeyman Wheel, the Curse of the Boogeyman we already mentioned, and then the last one is actually, and I think it's by far the best one. It's the most sincere one. It's by far the best acting, and I think the best directing and everything too. Best writing is Son of Sam. I just finished Son of Sam, and I'm really this is the one that I really kind of identify with. I like that film a lot.
Cool. And what's on tap for the future? Is Son of Sam the last Uli Lommel Lionsgate horror flick, or do you have more for under contract?
Well, it's the last one of these kind of serial killer, you know, kind of things. I think probably at least right now I need some time to contemplate and think about everything. But I'm writing a script about Frankenstein, and I want to update it, and I want to make it about a young college quarterback who dies, and then he becomes Frankenstein. And I like this iconic idea of putting two icons together, an American football quarterback and Frankenstein. So that's what I'm working on right now.
So how, in your mind, what is this Frankenstein character going to be like? Because there's a lot of different definitions, thanks to the film world, of what Frankenstein is. Hey everybody, we are back with the third part of the Uli Lommel interview, as thanks to me just buying Skype minutes a few minutes ago, I am limited to 15 minutes per phone call. So as a result, we're going to get cut off with Uli once again in about 14 minutes. But until then, Uli was just about to tell us about his conception of the Frankenstein character in his... do you have a title in mind for the film?
We just want to call it right now just Frankenstein. And of course, to clarify something, I mean, the monster is not Frankenstein. I mean, the creator is Frankenstein. And the creator in my script version is a college medicine student who, ever since he's a kid, likes to mess around with things and life and death and everything like that. And so when his buddy quarterback dies, you know, they do a funeral, and they have him, like, in his quarterback outfit, and they put him in his grave, and in his outfit, and so he gets him out of the grave, and then it's this stormy night and everything, and the quarterback turns into the monster. So that's my concept of it. I can share that much with you, even though they all say, no, don't tell anybody. But I think that's a cool concept, and from there the movie takes off. So these are the first kind of 10, 12 minutes of the film.
Well, thank you for letting us in on the details on those, on your upcoming films. And so let's hear a little bit before we get on to some of the questions that were submitted to me about The Tomb, which is out in June.
Oh, okay. The Tomb is about revenge. A guy who has certain grievances and grudges with people gets one after the other and then puts them in the tomb, and then they have to figure out how to get out there. And it has a lot of clues that have to do with H.P. Lovecraft, and so it's about H.P. Lovecraft as an author. It's about the tomb. It is about other elements of H.P. Lovecraft, and it is about this guy that has a grudge with these people. That's about as much as I have ever talked about this movie, because, you know, of course, nobody wants me to talk about and give too much away, but this is about as much as I can tell you.
Okay, and now let's go to some questions that I have in front of me. These were submitted long ago, and we were going to do an interview to promote God knows what film that was, but it was a while ago. But the questions are still good. These two that we're going to talk about are from Daniel Farmer, and he asks, please ask Uli about a sci-fi movie he produced about 10 years ago called Aurora Encounters, starring Danny Fendley. And he wants to know if it was ever released on DVD in any country, because he wanted to not only hear a little bit about the making of that film, but he wanted to get his hands on a copy.
Okay, I've never heard of that film, to tell you the truth. I don't know, maybe he has another title or something I did, but I never heard about that movie.
And you know what? Now that I look at your IMDb, it's not on here, so... Young Daniel, thank you for confusing myself and my guest. But this one will, yeah, it's a hell of a title.
Yeah.
And this one you can answer. Said he wanted to ask if it was true that Susanna Love was a big part of the financing of some of the films that you did with her, because I know that you two were married for a time.
That's
as well.
Yeah, that's just a rumor. She wasn't involved at all in the financing. She was involved in the conception. I mean, we were married for 10 years. We lived together, of course, for 10 years. And, you know, we came up with a lot of the concepts. She worked on the script. She worked on the production. She was a major part of all these movies. But she wasn't involved financially. That's just... I mean, I wouldn't have minded it. I mean, it would have been okay, but, you know, that's just not what happened.
Okay. And I know that... tell us about Susanna, now that I think about it. She was a big part of your career, and she was the star of many of your movies, so you have to have some stories about working with Susanna.
Oh, yeah. I met Susanna in... New York during the casting of Blank Generation, and she ended up playing a small part, not the lead that I was actually casting. The lead was, then Carol Bouquet, a French actress, that later on went on to make For Your Eyes Only, one of the Bond movies. But that was Susanna's first movie, and we got along really well. We fell in love, we got married, and in 1978. And then after Blank Generation, she starred in Cocaine Cowboys. And then after Cocaine Cowboys, we came up with Boogeyman. She starred in Boogeyman. Then she starred in Olivia. Then she starred in Brainwave. Then she starred in Devin's Terra. Then she starred in Revenge of a Soul Stars. And each time she looked different. I mean, and we always tried to, you know, have a lot of fun with making her look completely different. Sometimes, you know, the crew that I used over and over, when she showed up for the first time on the set, they didn't recognize her, like in Devin's Terra. with her short, kind of carrot-like hair, or suddenly, you know, later she's blonde, and before that she was always, you know, like dark brown hair and boogie men and stuff. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun working together. We had a great time, and I really liked her quality, her sensibility, and what she always brought to the role was, I think, very truthful, and it helped a lot to pull the audience in, and I think the movies I made with her, especially Boogeyman, Brainwaves, Olivia, and Devil's Montana, are pretty cool movies.
And, yeah, I've only seen a few of your older movies. I'm hoping that one day a lot of them do wind up getting released on DVD, but... And actually, now that I think about it, with that in mind, at what point did you start producing your own films and, as a result, would own them yourself?
I always did that, even way back in Germany. I tried to see what happened is when I was 22 years old, I had already been an actor for like 18 years, and I wanted to expand, and I started writing. And then I was looking for a director, and then I said, well, yeah, I may as well direct it myself. And people kept me, well, how can you direct... You never directed before. I said, well, the minute you direct, I guess you're a director, right? So then I said, but I need a producer. And I was looking for a producer, but it was such a pain in the ass to find somebody. And so I said, well, I may as well produce myself. And then the same people said, well, how about you never produced a movie before? And I said, well, you know, the minute you produce, I guess you're a producer. So I started writing, producing, and directing from day one. And that's how I kept throughout my career. And most of my movies... I don't know how many movies I directed, but I guess maybe like 40 or 50. Most of them, except for a handful, I also own.
Okay, and on to the next question, which is actually probably one of the films that you don't own. You did a film in 1991 called The Big Sweat.
Right. That
in which... Yeah, there. In which the person says that there was something like a 35-minute car chase.
Right.
This needs to come up on YouTube or something, because a 35-minute car chase sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Actually, the 35-minute car chase is part of what one of the greatest stuntmen of all time, who unfortunately died during a stunt like 10 years ago or whatever, H.P. Halicki. He did all that stuff, and so I bought from him this phenomenal, phenomenal footage, and I shot this whole movie around it. So The Big Sweat and Cold Heat are two movies that I did back-to-back with H.P. Halicki using all his awesome footage, and he was probably the best stuntman ever. Like I said, unfortunately, a couple of years later, he was killed during the stunt while he was shooting the movie.
So I didn't. I know.
It's gone in 60 seconds.
What was that? I'm sorry.
Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry. What was that?
His most famous movie, H.P. Halicki's most famous movie, was called Gone in 60 Seconds.
Oh, okay. Yeah, of course. And the next question we have here says, did you have any legal troubles when making your movie about Marilyn Monroe?
No, I didn't, it never got a major release in the United States, so, you know, we never really found out, but there were, like, conflicting theories on it. Some said, well, you can't use her image, which we did from, like, you know, news footage. Others said, you can. I mean, at that time, like, I think it was about... 16 years ago, so at that time it was in murky water. Today, all this whole copyright stuff, and there's a whole estate, the Monroe estate, and they're controlling, like, God knows what, just like the Elvis estate, you know, they're controlling everything, every marketing thing, there's, like, red wine with Marilyn on it, some red wine and stuff, you know. So today it would probably be much more difficult to do, but I also... found an actress. She was really amazing, and I shot in Super 8 with her, like all sorts of flashbacks of Marilyn. And so that, of course, you I guess you can do, but it's the real footage that was controversial back then, and to this very day, I guess. But like I said, the movie never found a substantial release in the United States.
Have you found that making movies and thus not necessarily having a U.S. distributor, a movie can still be profitable?
Yes, absolutely, because you got like some 100 territories out there, and whether it's the Philippines or Taiwan or Brazil or Australia or Luxembourg or Eastern Europe, but it goes on and on and on and on. There are like 100 countries. And that I made in the past that I sold to every possible territory in the world. And America sometimes is a iffy market because, it's the biggest market, and they also use the biggest movies, the biggest Hollywood movies. And so, sometimes you sell a movie in the United States, sometimes you don't. And the plus is right now with the movies I made the last 2 years is that I always knew from the beginning that I had Lionsgate behind it, and that was pretty good compared to other times where I was struggling to find the United States distributor in the United States.
Yeah, it seems like as you go down your IMDb, there's a whole lot of films that pretty much have zero information available about them, probably because of that, without the U.S. distribution.
Right, exactly. There are some movies that were only released in a few territories here or there. But, I also sometimes go out on a limb and try to do stuff that is kind of different. I feel sometimes really like an archaeologist that goes out there and looks for something and if I find something good, but if I don't find something, that's okay too. It's more like the Buddhist saying, the path is the goal, So sometimes I've done that in the past, and there's another side to me that is very experimental. And I think some of these horror movies that I made with Lionsgate in the last few years, I think some of that stuff there is pretty experimental stuff as well. And some people, don't like that much. Some people are even offended by it. Some people, are annoyed by it. But to me, no matter what, I like to experiment, and I like to, go to different frontiers. I like to do all the different things that I've done before. One of the reasons why I hated doing the sequel for Boogeyman is that I didn't want to do the same thing all over again, and I wanted to move on to other things. I think life is so short that to do a bunch of sequels, I don't know, like if I were with Sam Raimi right now, and for the last 4 years and for the next 2 years, all he does is Spider-Man. I think that might be good for him, and he certainly makes billions of dollars, but I never was interested in money that much, and I was always interested in something.
Uli?
Yes?
I think we're going to get cut off right here. Let's hope not.
Okay.
Keep going, please.
Yeah, I wasn't interested in money in the first place and in the deal. I always wanted to go to other places with everything, and if I lose money with it, that's fine. So, I'm more of a maverick kind of guerrilla type than, the big money people.
And that's an attitude that I can really respect, because even though a lot of us, us film critics and whatnot, and just the normal people that rent the films, a lot of us may not like everything that Uli Lommel does, but at the very least, you're doing it because you're making your own vision of what it should be. You're not trying to make a movie that's instantly going to make money or just copying what other people have done. That's when making a bad movie really tends to offend a lot of us.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that really, I stick with pretty much. And to me also, the other thing that's important is that I can feed a whole bunch of people for 2 years. That otherwise wouldn't have a job, maybe. And that we all can, maybe in the course of it, learn or understand something in many different ways, whether it's the movies, whether it's making movies together, whether it's this or that. And I've had in my career, amazing moments where, for example, I was in post-production for Blank Generation. I happened to be in Brooklyn at a cafe, and I was talking about the movie, and a kid comes, 20-year-old kid comes and says, "Look, I hear you're making a movie. I'm at the Music Academy in Brooklyn, and I want to be a composer. Can I do music for you?" And so he did the music for me for $500. It turned out to be you know, Elliot Goldenthal, who got the Oscar 4 years ago, or whatever that was, for Frida. So he made a huge career, and, you know, I found him on the streets of Brooklyn. And so I like empowering people and sharing stuff with people, and so same thing happened with Michael Ballhaus. You know, he's one of the top cinematographers in the world. He's gotten several Academy Award nominations. I discovered Michael in Germany. He did my first movie. And then I brought him over to America. He also did a lot of the staff in the movie. So I feel pretty good about, you know, sharing stuff with people and enabling people to do stuff and to move on from there and to do other stuff and whatever, you know. So action, you know, it's the action that counts for me too, that I have my own trip, I have my own way of doing things, but I also share this with a lot of people.
And let's hear about those people. I'm going to actually, actually before that, let's hear a bit more about your House of Horrors that you've built as a production studio.
Right. It's called, right now, it's been called the Hollywood House of Horror. And the main people are like Christian Bain, also called X-Jim. He is the editor and also the star of several movies. And he's, if he's not the star, then he plays one or the other role in all the movies. He helps me also assistant directing. He's a second unit director. And then Nola Roper, she's in every film. She also produces movies with me. Then there's Rachel Devlin. She does all the casting, and, you know, she takes care of all the actors. And then there's Max Nikoff. He produced the original Zodiac with me, and he is a very, very important part of all this in producing and camera, etc. And so I have a whole bunch of people that are like an important part of this, and they make every movie with me. So all the 16 movies, Christian, Nola, Max, and Rachel, they have done all 16 movies with me.
And are a lot of these people figures who hadn't had much experience in the industry before they got on the Uli Lomel truck?
Exactly. I mean, Nola has done stuff before, and she was a big radio personality in New York, and she made movies before, but Christian and Max and Rachel never done movies before. And when I met Christian, I just liked the way he went about things really a lot, and I said, Christian, you should edit the movie. He said, but I never edited before. I said, you know, I heard all of it. You know, the minute you edit, you're an editor. And just like me when I started directing and producing, that's just the way it is. And you know, whether you're a good editor, bad editor, I mean, that's a different story. But just go ahead and learn Final Cut Pro, check it out, and let's just do one together. And so our first movie was Zombie Nation, and then right after we did Green River Killer. And he's just been at it ever since, like pretty much 24/7.
So, with you making 16 movies in 2 years, what kind of shooting schedule do you wind up having for each individual film?
Okay, we have about 10-12 days shooting for each movie, but then we have an enormous amount, I mean relatively, for post-production, because you know, we spend a lot of time in music, we spend a lot of time in sound effects, and so it's sometimes it's a minimum of 6 weeks, sometimes can be up to 3 months. So because of that, we are sometimes in post-production for 5 movies at the same time. Like last November, it was 5 movies at the same time in post-production, 10 movies in production. So that was pretty crazy. And I remember me going, you know, Christian editing 2 of them, and Steve Meyer edited another one, and Bertrand Paré edited another one. And I mean, it was just absolute mayhem. But it felt, again, like a heavy metal band that was playing on 5 stages at the same time and running from stage, you know. So it was pretty cool, and, you know, but it was intense and crazy, and I never got to sleep. I mean, I don't know, in November, December of last year of 2006, I don't think I ever slept.
Because I remember when I scheduled the interview with you, probably last November it might have been, I got the email from you, and you're like, yeah, why don't you give me a call at 7:30 Pacific? And for me, even on the East Coast, that's 10:30 in the morning. I was thinking in my head, I'm like, oh, God, I have to wake up early. Meanwhile, Uli's up and ready to do an interview.
I think all through November, December, if I slept at all, it must have been between 3 and 4 in the morning. But we had, like, day shift, night shift. We had everything going on. And I think everybody complained about it, but at the same time, everybody loved it, you know. And it was so intense. And, we loved it.
It certainly does sound like an intense experience, the way that you're describing it. Five movies? Did you complete? Did you say you completed five movies in 2 months, or was it just
We were in post-production for five movies at the same time. Like I said, some movies take 3 months. Like Son of Sam right now, it's been in post-production now for 3 months already, you know. So even though we shoot these movies in 10 days, or some are even 12, 13 days, but mostly 10 days, usually what we do is, the movies are all like 80 minutes in length, so what we try to accomplish is to shoot like 7 or 8 minutes of screen time every day. I don't think that's too much, so, we have long hours to see that we shoot, and we have an operation that is very, it works very well. It's almost like a little military operation. And we're like all really focused, you know, everybody knows exactly what they're doing. So it's not one of these foods where you come and then the director is socializing with guests that show up at the set and nobody's really doing anything, and then you see like VFX set up today. So when we start like shooting at 6 in the morning until maybe midnight, or let's say it's like an 18-hour day, we shoot all the time. There's no time for socializing, no time for private life, or barely time to eat.
I guess that's one of the situations where you're incredibly happy that you're working with the young and hungry actors of the world rather than the bitching and whining.
Exactly. And of all these 15 movies, we maybe had actors that were bitching and whining, and so it's like 99.9% really understood the dynamics and the character and the fun and what's kept about and you know. I also want to mention that there are a whole bunch of actors that appear over and over in all these movies, like Alyssa Dowling, who sometimes called Alyssa Bray, who is the star of, she plays the mean girl in Battaglia. She's in like almost every movie. Nola Rocco, of course, is in every movie. And Dustin Aurora is in every movie. Christian, of course, is pretty much in every movie. And so I sometimes see guests appearing, like I play the priest that does the exorcism on Son of Sam and Son of Sam. So we have like really a repertory group. The House of Horror is a repertory group of people that, you know, like a circus. In the 60s there was a group called the Living Theater. And they toured the world. And they lived together, they worked together, and it was very political. We're very much EF-based, and so we feel a little bit, reluctant. And out of the group dynamics, you know, come a lot of stuff that we're working with.
And on that note, God, this has been an incredible 55 minutes. But we need to keep this hopefully under 60 to keep the listeners from having to quit their job to listen to the podcast.
Okay.
The good thing is that with how many movies you are producing and how many movies you have coming out from Lionsgate in the upcoming months, there are many and many opportunities to get you back on the show.
Okay, definitely. But it was great talking with you, by the way. I enjoyed it.
I did as well, but before we go, we have to get that last plug out there for your brand new movie, Diary of a Cannibal.
Okay.
So tell the people to go rent it.
Diary of a Cannibal is I think, much more of an European art house movie. About it's like almost like French love story gone crazy. So Jillian is really awesome as this woman who eats her boyfriend. She really is. If you hate everything else in the movie, if you hate my directing, you have to love her acting. She's great in that movie.
Sweet. So I will keep my lookout not only for the actual movie, Diary of a Cannibal, but Gillian Swanson's performance.
That's right.
And let me also add that Gillian's the only one. Looking at some of the cast lists for some of your films, she's one of the few actresses who's actually smart enough to get an IMDb headshot. So good for her.
Yeah,
but, so Diary of a Cannibal, by the time you listen to this, it'll be out on your video store shelf. Not necessarily the horror movie that it looks like, but if you're looking for a European art house cannibalism, relationship drama, semi-horror flick, it's out there waiting for you to pick it up. Uli Lomol, thank you once again for joining us.
Well, thank you. We'll do this soon again. Take care.
Absolutely. And this is Greg Conley signing off with the Your Video Store Shelf podcast. Have a wonderful day.